Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
We should just get going. Should we just get going? I think we should. Why don't we get going? Do you want to start? Or shall I tell you about my journey here? I could tell you about it.
I should do that.
I've had a really terrible experience. I'm finding it very hard to recover from, actually. In the last 10, 15 years, I've had a big problem on the telephone that people occasionally hear my voice and think that I'm Jeremy Clarkson. Okay, that's something I've learned to deal with. Because I'm a, you know, Southern Counties public school wanker, so I suppose. But anyway, something much worse just happened. I was on the tube and coming up to here, and the tube was packed with, well, I think we're Argentinian rugby fans. Argentina played last night, didn't they, right? Spanish, speaking Spanish anyway. And the only word I can understand that they're saying is Jeremy Clarkson. You say Jeremy Clarkson, and they're pointing at me. And I'm just sitting on the tube reading a book. I'm not speaking. I'm reading a book. So I now not only sound like Jeremy Clarkson, I apparently look like Jeremy Clarkson. And a load of people stepped... I'm so heartbroken about this. A load of people stepped in and said, very sweetly, said, look, it's not Jeremy Clarkson. Please leave him alone.
Hey, Clarkson. And of course, you'll all be aware that last time Jeremy Clarkson went to Argentina, he had to leave in somewhat... something of a hurry. And so this is probably a death squad that's been sent all the way. They're just going round the tubes.
I hadn't realised. Lucky to be alive, is your point.
While we're talking about things that happened to Mark in this region, I couldn't let this opportunity go by without letting you know that the last time Mark was in Islington, which is about a week ago, yes?
Yeah.
And Mark was interviewing Chris Salovitz at Waterston's... round the corner, and go on. Tell everybody what happened afterwards, Mark.
Just around the corner from here, and me and two mates went for a drink. We said, "What's the nearest pub? And we'll meet you all there." We went to the Slug and Lettuce. Slug and Lettuce. Never been to a Slug and Lettuce. Please never go to a Slug and Lettuce. Well, I had no option because I wasn't allowed in. We got there, and two enormous ape-like bouncers outside got hold of my mate, who's probably here, actually, the great Caroline Grimshaw from Word magazine, who was wearing a hat. She said, "She's not going in there wearing a hat, mate." And I said, "That'd be ridiculous." She said, "Are you calling me ridiculous?" And he got a hold of me, and he physically dragged me out of the Slug and Lettuce, out into Upper Street. And he said, "You're saying it's ridiculous that I am doing what I am enforced to do, which is to enforce the rules and regulations." I'm about to be arrested again now. It's astonishing. The sound of young Islington, exactly. And anyway, what I'm proud of is I was thrown out of a Slug and Lettuce. At my age, which is slightly better. I think of that as being a compliment.
Have you ever been thrown out of a pub before?
Never, no.
You get to this advanced age.
No, it's great. All these things are happening. But look, let's get the show rolling. Fantastic to see you all. This is terrific. Now, if you've ever been to see the Stones recently, or Dylan, or Stevie Wonder, or Peter Gabriel, or Lady Gaga, it's highly likely that this guy was directing their stage show, and in the last 35 years, he's seen the role of the lighting man change from the kind of, old roadie with a follow spot, and a big load of keys, to somebody in the control room effectively running the whole show. And he's even directed the Olympic opening ceremony. So has worked with the Queen, all the greats. So I'm hoping we're going to hear about that, and also Michael Jackson and Golden Earring. So please welcome the fantastic Patrick Woodruff. Here he is. And Patrick, we're going to start. This is a picture of you in the office with a pair of binoculars, which gives you some idea of how huge...
At the age now that I don't just need spectacles, I need binoculars wherever I go. This was in the control room of the Olympic Games, and they built us this extraordinary control room. Clearly, we had to have a room that could see the whole of the track. It was built right at the top of the stairs. It was beautiful, air-conditioned, dry. We were the only people who didn't get wet in the whole 6 weeks before the Olympics. But they said, "Where do you want it? You can have it anywhere you like." And I said, "I'll have it right opposite the end of the 100 metres, on the off chance that I might be there that night on some spurious charge," because we were all crowded in that night when we saw Usain Bolt do his business. But yeah, it was a very big stadium, and you needed binoculars to see what was going on.
But you, when you start working with musicians, you go to them. I remember you telling me you started working with Dylan, I think it was, and you go to them and you say, "Well, how would you like to look? which, in fact, here is Dylan, in fact, on stage, hopefully lit by you. Do you want to look enigmatic? Do you want to look sexy? Do you want to look mysterious or whatever? That's how it works, I think. That's the beginning of the conversation.
I think it's more general than that. I think you're trying to make a connection with these people. And sometimes they know clearly what they want. Sometimes they don't know what they want at all. But it's simply about making some kind of relationship with them. But I was looking at the picture of Paul McCartney, and I had done a few things with him. He called me one day. He said, "Hey, is Paul here?" And he said, "I'm going to be doing this show at the White House in Washington. I'd really like you to come and help me do it." So we talked. It was a nice conversation, and he hung up the phone. And that night, I remember going out to dinner, a very good dinner, and writing a rather long, involved email to him. Had nothing to do with lighting at all. It was about what I thought he should wear and what songs I thought she should sing and what he should start by playing Michelle because Michelle Obama was there. And then I did broke the golden rule of sending an email after 9 o'clock at night to somebody that I don't really know very well, telling me exactly what he should do. Of course, I didn't hear a word back from him until I got to Washington 2 weeks later, rather nervously, and he saw me come and he went, "Hey, Pat, love the email." So... that I got away with, but it's still a rule that shouldn't be broken. No emails.
But I love the idea that you're also involved in telling people what to wear. So that's part of the whole spectacle, isn't it?
I mean, I think, you know, it's really interesting. A lot of these people, you know, they're extraordinary performers and they're incredibly confident. I've worked with the Rolling Stones for 32 years. But still, people like Jagger, who's one of the great frontmen, the great performer, would be very interested to hear an opinion of somebody like me or somebody who works with them of how it might be or how you could make it better. Or I think there's an innate sense of insecurity about standing up in front of 85,000 people, however many times you've done it before. So the support of people who understand the process, you know, the craft of being a performer is important to them.
So there's a lot of planning goes on before first night, obviously.
Yeah, and more so than it used to be. I mean, many shows now are very theatrical. And when I started, of course, you stood up with some lights and you went on stage and you performed. Maybe kind of Peter Gabriel-ish dressing up as a tree business went on. But now it's much more considered. People go on stage on time. A lot of the stuff that is controlled lighting video is done with time code and on computers that have to be. I mean, it can still be visceral. It can still be exciting.
Well, to get across the scale of this, I think we got a picture of one of the groups you first worked with. There they are. I don't have to tell you a lot, of course. It's the Mighty Golden Earring. You know that. We all know that. But that's roughly when you started. It also reminds you just how primitive the whole thing was, because we're going to see an extraordinary picture in a minute of the spectacle of a stadium. But, I mean, what was it like when you, in those days, what were you required to do, lighting a group like that?
When I started, I used to go on the road with rock bands working for a very small lighting company, but the only lighting company in England, called ESP Lighting. And you'd go out with some par cans, 1,000-watt par cans, no trusses, just bolted onto towers, and you'd drive the car and take a lot of speed to stay awake. And until I worked with Golden Earring, who didn't take speed, but they smoked hashish, and the tour manager was the biggest dope dealer in Amsterdam, so I had a different sensibility about how I saw things slow down.
A bit relaxed. Sometimes there's no lights at all.
But there wasn't really an understanding that you were a lighting designer. You did the lights. And we had these very small control boards which just had some faders and some flash buttons, and you would do the light.
And
sometimes you'd say, "Are you going to do them tonight or shall I?" And then I worked for a band called the Heavy Metal Kids, who were really smart, Gary Holton, really smart kind of punk rock band. And then I learnt the theatre of lighting. We had a tiny little lighting system, but a year of working with them in little clubs and things around Europe, I really understood about the timing of lighting and how you use colour and how you connected lighting to. So when I got my big break, which was with Rod Stewart, he fired his lighting design just before he did his biggest solo tour, his first solo tour, and I got the job. I was ready. I understood how lighting worked and what that stuff meant.
So was it during that time with Heavy Metal Kids, we're talking about sort of mid to late 70s or something like that, is that when bands started to think about presentation a lot more?
I think they did. I mean, a lot of it came from technology. So the Pink Floyd, for example, you know, they had lasers because somebody said, well, there's this thing called lasers, let's use lasers. Well, it was lasers would just be set off. But slowly but surely, I think, yes, from the 80s onwards, we started to really understand what production meant and how you could really enhance a show. And it became very specific that the thing became a grown-up operation. when bands stopped playing in theatres and started playing in arenas, and then carried on from arenas to start playing in stadia. Because as soon as you did that, you had to have good sound systems, and you had to have good lighting, and you had to sell people on something that was interesting. And as soon as it happened and a few people got into it, then of course it became quite competitive, which behoved people like me who were making a career from it, because everyone wanted something that was bigger and better and newer and more interesting than the next one. And now it's a very grown-up industry. And I'm 61, and I'm thrilled that I've had both sides of it. You know, I like to do the work that I do now because you can put on extraordinary productions with smart, bright, young people who know what they're doing, wonderful lights that change and move colour, and video screens that move around, and huge scenery and stage sets. But at the same time, we had that extraordinary feeling when you would travel around the world. In 1977-79, I travelled around the world with Rod Stewart, and there were eight of us on the crew, and it was some fantasy to travel around the world with great rock music. And
well, we've got a, I think we've got a picture next of the kind of a control deck. Is that the next picture? Of a stone. Here it is. Oh, that's an amazing picture. This picture for viewers at home, for listeners at home, is just an amazing. It's like a sort of flight deck of a spaceship.
Yeah, and it's
astonishing.
A small part of it, but yeah, clearly there's an enormous amount of technology. This was at the Olympics, and this was just as Thomas Heatherwick's Olympic cauldron. And you know, it's quite interesting if you do a big show. The biggest pressure we get is not so much just doing a big rock show with the Stones or something. There's 60, 70,000 people maybe watching it, but it's not the end of the world if something goes wrong. But the stakes were pretty high there. And it's normally what happens if you're filming a show, a big live performance. After you've got through the first 20 minutes, you can see it's looking pretty good. And you go, oh, now we'll be okay, we can relax. But on this, you know, just as you got through the amazing chimney going up scene, then you had the helicopter to come, and you better not get that right. And then you had the entrance of the Queen, and then you had this, and then you had the cauldron. So we couldn't relax until the fireworks from the Pink Floyd happened. At which point, I remember saying to my crew chief, well, that went pretty well, didn't it, Rich? He said, yeah, he's a very kind of sanguine, cool guy, very reliable. I said, any problems? He said, no, not really. He said, well, actually, about an hour before the show started, only three of the Olympic rings were working.
That's right.
And it had been very bad weather, and they were literally on the top of the stadium with hairdryers trying. Remember that beautiful moment when they all floated over? Imagine what it would have been like. I said, you didn't say anything to me, and he looked at me like like I was a fool and said,
you didn't need
I didn't think there was an awful lot you could do about it.
No.
With a show like that, is there one person in that stadium who's calling the shots?
Her name is Julia. And Julia is from Essex, and she's the show caller. In the theatre, you have a DSM, a deputy stage manager, sits at the side of the stage and goes, LXQ 53, go, and SoundQ 42, go, and there's like eight people listening to her. Julia had 220 people on the comm system. And I secretly, you told me this is broadcast, didn't you? I have the recordings of Julia calling 200 people and calling the entrance to the Queen and calling the helicopter and calling the fireworks. And I said, I saw Kenneth Branagh the other day at the airport, and he, of course, did his lovely, you know, his big speech. And I was telling him that on the tape, there's a great moment. He has an earpiece, as every one of the 3,000 performers had earpieces, all the volunteers. So Kenneth is standing by, and you're hearing Julia calling 1,000 things. LXQ 53, automation cue this, horses to come on here. Stand by Ken. And you see Ken standing, looking like this. And then she says, go, Ken. And he says, oh, these sceptre dials. He does this wonderful thing. And he finishes, and you just hear this voice go, good lad, good lad.
You get the impression, looking at this, that it must take some of the spontaneity out of rock shows, clearly, because it's
not really. So
you could still change.
I think this is me, and this is my partner, Adam. He did most of the talking, because they at a certain point, would stop listening to me, because I would get rather excited. So I think they actually changed my switch on the night so that I couldn't actually talk to anybody. But it was not strictly true, but there were 73 people on my team, all on headsets. So big, all the spotlight operators were 38 of them, I think. They were all volunteers. and we had half a dozen board operators. But, you know, it was computerized in that when LXQ63 was called, everyone pressed their buttons and certain things happened. So all that was recorded and was created, but it's still pretty live when you press that button, when somebody presses the button.
We could just show a picture of Stevie Wonder, actually, which is really interesting because... Oh, no, he's got the stone. We've got the Stones.
No, that's Stevie Wonder thinks his show looks like this, but...
That's a fantastic picture. So that gets across just the incredible spectacle.
So, yeah, but so you started as a kind of a standard rock and roll kind of lighting man, yes? Without theatre training or anything like that? Or did you?
No,
you
not at all.
But you've slowly had to, you know, it's moved into theatre, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I do a lot of theatre shows, probably less than half the work I do now. Rock concerts, I make the lighting for theatre, for opera, for architectural things, for events and stuff. But the interesting thing about rock concerts is, you know, with the Stones, when I started working with them in 1982, I had very little to do with them. But then I, through the 80s, I worked with Mick on his solo career because the band didn't work for 7 years or something. So when they got together in 1989 for Steel Wheels, which was the real game changer in terms of production, at that point, I had worked a lot with Mick, and we started to understand things like, you know, how did you walk onto the stage? You know, do you go from the left or the right? What do you say? When do you say, hello, Wembley? Do you see it straight away? Or, and he's a man of huge craft. He's extraordinary to watch him perform. And so by the time we got to 1989, and the show was designed by the late, great Mark Fisher, who was this wonderful architect who died a couple of years ago, very sadly. But he changed the way that rock concerts were. In the past, we had simply hung up some screens left and right, maybe the name of the record on it, and you had some lights. And Mark started to create these three-dimensional buildings. Steel Wheels was this huge thing. And from that were the big Floyd shows, the big... So, but by this time, this is fairly recently. This was just last year, I think, in Paris, this show. So, you know, and also there's a big deal between when you put up a light with a gel in it and you put up a light that you could press a button that could turn to any colour and move to any position. Well, we're all used to this now. But to be able to have, you know, in the old days, if I had, I can't remember, there's like 300 or 400 lights here, I would have had to choose that one was red, that one was blue, that one was green, that one was shining at the drums, that was, and then control them. Now I can press a button and they can all be white or all be blue. So it was about that time. Sorry, it was about that time that things started to become serious.
There's a lovely
serious bit
in your... Patrick's written some terrific diaries recording all this, which I hope very much will be published soon. And there's a bit where Keith Richards talks about, they just get used to the scale of it. He says the venues come in three sizes, like Fruit of the Loom underwear. That's small, right. Medium and large. Right. And also it's very sweet about Mick Jagger. He says Mick Jagger can work a coffee table. Yeah. You can put him on a coffee table and still put on the show, which is really interesting.
You know, I watch him sometimes, and he does. He can play in a club. Literally, I've seen him play in a club like this, and he can play a coffee table. But what's interesting about him and about many, all the great performers, is it's not just about being in the moment. It's not just about doing the best version of Wild Horses that you can and emoting. You've also got to say, okay, on the second verse, I'm going to go over there because on the last one I did over there, or the crowd are a bit hot, I'm going to have to cool them down because there's another hour to go, or... You know, I can see at one point, you know, he went out on the runway and I think the generator had gone and there were no lights on. He could tell that there were no spotlights on him, so he had to stand on the stage. And then as he passed the others, he had to say to them, make sure you don't go. So this is a craft and not a... And I just came back from Brazil today. I was doing Rock in Rio in Rio de Janeiro, and there was a band there called The Script. I don't know if you know. And I saw this. I knew nothing about them. They were second to Queen. I think Queen were the headliners. And I was looking at this guy who was the singer, and he just had it. You could tell. And I went back to see him afterwards, and without being patronising, trying terribly hard not to be patronising, telling him that I think he's going to be a huge star. And you see these people who they get it, that they have huge legitimacy, they have genuine authenticity, but they're able to hold an audience like that. And that mix of art and craft is something that I've watched 100 performers doing over the years and is absolutely fascinating discipline to understand.
Nowadays, the kind of the what used to be called diamond vision in its early days, you know, the big screens, what we all thought is miraculous that you could suddenly see from the back of Wembley Stadium, you know, the performers' features. This visualization that on TV screens, on screens, is a huge part of the show, isn't it, nowadays? I mean, and it must be the kind of colluding with whoever's directing the pictures.
There is that, but on the other hand, you have to be very careful that it's not just a TV show. I mean, it's very difficult. So we started to... it used to be that always the IMAG screens, image magnification, we call them IMAG, would be left and right. And then I realised people spend most of their time looking there not when looking the action the was there. So we started to build the video screens behind the stage. And then sometimes I'll turn them off or I'll put other things on them or you'll put some content on them to try and... But, you know, if you're in a big stadium, you want to see somebody's face. What a thrill that is to see somebody that close up.
Yeah, yeah.
The Bruce Springsteen shows really are cued like television. The internal dynamic of all the members
Well,
of the group.
Because he never does anything on stage that the camera doesn't catch.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
So they've rehearsed those looks that they do to each other. And it's a very big integral part of the show.
It always strikes me that it's like a TV show.
Yeah, so the person who's directing the television images and the lighting person, and he's had the same people with him for years, and that's becomes very important.
I only put up this Stevie Wonder thing because I thought it was so interesting, the idea that you're trying to explain the concept of colour to somebody who can't see it. And it's really, really fascinating. You know, blue is cool and enigmatic. Or yeah. What do you say?
So I worked with him for the first time in 1984 or something, and he's a pretty special guy. He's everything that you would imagine. He's very big, and he smells beautiful. I always remember that when Lucy met him, my wife met him for the first time. His smell, he's got his lovelies. Anyway, I would talk to about him.
We've all learned
strange,
something.
Strange. Now, let me tell you about how Paul McCartney smells. No. But he was wonderful, and I would talk to him about colour, and I would talk to him, but he used to talk about vision as that other thing. Hey, that other thing. And after these, you know, kind of late night conversations in hotel rooms where we would, you know, he's quite sort of spacey, I thought, no, I can't explain what that other thing is, but I can explain to him how I could take that away from everybody else. And so we had this really special part of the show. We did it for the first time at the Budokan in Tokyo, I can remember. And he, four or five numbers into the show, he would say, hey, Patrick, turn out the lights. And very slowly we would fade all the lights down on the stage and the musicians would turn off their reading lights and the sound engineers on stage and sometimes we'd get all the emergency lights turned out. And he would say, I want to take you to this other place. I can see Martin Luther King. And he'd start to play the introduction to Visions of My Mind, you know, that beautiful song, His Hopes for a Better World. And for 7 minutes, this connection between him and the audience was as one. And that's all a performer really needs to do. I think it's true of any discipline, performing discipline, whether it's, you know, the opera, the ballet, or the theatre, or Benedict Cumberbatch being his Hamlet, or Mick Jagger, or Bob Dylan. Somewhere, you have to make that connection with an audience. And that's how he did it, and it was extraordinarily moving.
We were talking earlier about the idea that, you know, if you're a journalist, your relationship with musicians is pretty fraught. If you're a photographer or a hairstylist or a lighting technician, your job is entirely to be sympathetic and supportive, to make them look and feel fabulous. And so you've developed a really good relationship with a lot of these people. You know, you spent an extraordinary amount of time you spent with Dylan, driving around in his car and lovely descriptions of him padding about with no feet, no shoes on.
No feet on, sorry.
Yeah, the wonders of lighting. Yeah. So do you feel you've got some real insights into how these
people work?
You're
not suggesting that the relationships with the people I've worked with have never been fraught, are you, Mark?
Well, no. Didn't you fall out with Keith at one point? I can't remember.
He tried to shoot me twice, I think, or at least he suggested that he might. He's the most wonderful man. He's gentle, he's funny, he's very funny, he's bright, but for many years he was a drug addict and an alcoholic. And it meant that you were never sure which Keith you were going to get. And a few times we've had some run-ins, but now is a beautiful time for him because he doesn't take drugs and he doesn't drink now. I don't know how old he is, but and you only get the good Keith. And I think Sorry, go ahead.
Let me ask you this: that from your position, you know, the general feeling about the Stones is that the general consensus is that Mick Jagger is a kind of a slightly controlling businessman, and Keith Richards is a warm-hearted, rambunctious music lover. And in my experience, that's simply not true. You know, they have elements of that, but they both have elements of each other. Did you feel the same way? I mean, there was a cartoon version of what the Stones look like.
Yeah, and I think it's something that develops all the time. I mean, clearly Mick is very much not the controlling force, but certainly the one who drives the mechanics of the touring. But they're still a group of four people, and they still have exactly the same dynamics that are good and bad, and somebody has a good day and a bad day. But no, for sure, Mick is the person who steers what we're doing and where we go, and also is very connected with the music and what we're playing. And Keith is not so interested in what the stage might look like, but it better be right. And so he's always included, as all four of them are included in what the thing is right. But it's a very public, the kind of yin and yang of Mick and Keith's relationship. But it's in a great place now, which is the sweetest thing.
So just to go back to Mark's point about the extent to which they depend on the lighting man. You know, they always say with actors, you know, if you're making movies, you better know the lighting person because they're the one that's going to make you look good.
And to be honest, in film, it's a much more technical issue because you're just really looking at how you make somebody look, and that's not really what I do, although it's important, of course, particularly working with women, to get somebody looking really fabulous and get the balance right and the balance for the camera, particularly with the big screens. It's really important.
I'm going to say, these people are in a very curious position of still touring at the absolute top of the game in their 60s and their 70s when they've looked better in their lives.
Of course it does. I mean, you know, you're seeing somebody's, you know, ravaged face on occasion on a screen that's 40 feet high. So we tend to shoot a little wider as the shots get a little wider as they get older. You could call it vanity or you could just call it pragmatism, really. And it's up to all of us to make them look as good as they can, you know.
Right.
But there's certainly, you know, Keith doesn't really matter what you do. He still looks great. So that's not so much of an issue.
What about Bob Dylan?
Bob was really interesting. He's a really interesting man. You know, he's all the things you would imagine. He's very enigmatic. He's incredibly private. And the first time I met him, I had a call from his manager saying, Bob wants to meet you. He wants you to come and make the lighting for his next tour. And I thought this was some sort of joke because in our business, it's known that he's always been very tricky about his lighting. He wouldn't talk to his lighting guys. He would often take the microphone and just move them into a dark and do whole numbers in darkness. But the reason that he called me was that he had opened for the Stones in South America. We'd done some dates in South America and he had opened for the Stones. And he'd come and watch from the side of the stage every night. And I've always taken the same approach with the lighting of the Stones, as in many bands, but certainly the Stones. I put a white spotlight on each one of them for the whole 2.5 hours of the performance. And then I make a big thing around them. If it's a ballad, it can be mood and sexy and nice, or if it's a big rock number, lights can be going, and it's quite considered. But at all the times, you can see the four of them, because my view is if you've paid the money and Keith Richards doing a guitar solo, you still might want to look at Charlie Watts. He thought this was a stroke of genius, because his lighting guys would put a light on him and kind of leave the rest of the band in darkness, yeah, as you might do with the solo performers. You're not going to light, you know, Barbara Streisand's third violinist the same brightness that you light Barbara Streisand. But being Bob, he hadn't actually thought that the way to fix the problem would just be to say something to somebody. The best way to fix the problem would be to move the microphone. So when he saw this, he thought this was some new way of lighting. So I've worked with him for a long time now, and he's wonderful, enigmatic, but he can be funny as well. And the first time I ever met him, I met him at the sound check, and he shuffled him with his hood, and you want to talk a little bit? And then when I saw him a little bit later, they said, I'll come to his dressing room, and he was dressed like this, ready to go on stage. Hey, come on in, he said. Let me pull up a chair for you. And I thought it sounded like a...
He speaks like Bob Dylan.
Yeah, he speaks like Bob Dylan, and it could be the line of a song. It's a good name for a song. Let me pull up a chair for you.
How was he described, Dave? You mentioned it the other day. Somebody said he looked like, was it Vincent Price playing a Mexican cowboy?
Yeah, it was the best.
That's his new look.
It was David Remnick, the editor of New Yorker, right, on a podcast, said he looks like Vincent Price playing a Mexican cowboy.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Which is a really good...
I think we got another shot of, again, to get across the scale of it. Where we got to? Yeah, this is the one. Well, again, we just come back from Rio. Here we are. This is the Copacabana Beach concert by the Rolling Stones. I can't now remember what it was, about 2010, something like that. And it's just fascinating because there's so much competition. Around this time, McCartney, I think, had played a concert in Milan, a free concert in Milan, which 500,000 people attended. And there's that wonderful sense of competition that these guys never get over.
You know,
which
is what's really unfair is that the person who holds the record for the largest concert that anyone's ever come to see is Rod Stewart. And the reason is that this is the Copacabana, and this is 5 kilometres long. And on New Year's Eve, it has this many people from one end to the other. And they have odd stages up there. And Rod played here and somehow managed to swing it that the 5 million people who turned up that night had all come to see him. So he's in the Guinness Book of Records. But actually, we have the record. The Rolling Stones played to 1.8 million people. And they came just to see them. And the best thing about this is that if you're in a very big, what we would call the greenfield site, after you being in the biggest stadium that you could get in, which is 100,000 people, American or somewhere, you then play greenfield sites, which is like Glastonbury or... And people have played to big crowds, 500,000 people. But when you're filming that, you don't really have a sense of how many people there are here. But here you do, because this is the Avenida Atlantica, which is the road here that was closed off. And all the way along it are these buildings. I mean, our concert was from down here somewhere up to here. So you have all these buildings that very clearly defines the site on that side. And you have the sea that very clearly defines the site on that side. So with all the helicopters they had flying around, it looked extraordinary. And out here, this had 300 or 400 boats all moored up. And they had this kind of cordon sanitaire here that you weren't allowed to put a boat behind, and had all the police boats zooming backs and forwards with their lights on and helicopters going everywhere. And then here you had every single apartment all with people on the balconies with all the lights on behind them, all silhouetted. So you had a very
incredible,
clear sense of what 1.5 million people
so
looked like.
I have to say, I realised just how crucial Patrick's relationship with the Rolling Stones was when I was watching them at Glastonbury. Do you remember that? And Mick Jagger suddenly says to the crowd and to the television audience, says, could you put lights on the crowd, Patrick? And he's actually talking to Patrick from the stage. I was very, very impressed.
But you're obviously getting a very different view. It's so interesting hearing you talk about that because... You know, Mick Jagger and everybody else, they're doing their bit. Whereas you're looking at the big picture, aren't you? So do you look at other locations in the world and think, I'd like to do so-and-so there? I can always get bigger.
No, not really. I haven't thought about that. But, yeah, maybe not, because when I see somewhere that would be a magnificent place to put a rock concert on, instinctively I know how difficult it would be to put it up. So this was pretty great because everything was... right there in front of
But acts are, going back to what you were talking about, acts are very, they're very competitive with each other, aren't they? They keep an eye on who's broken
which
record.
But I think it's quite, Mick went to see U2 the other day and he said, you have to see this show, it's just fantastic and it completely kind of game changing. So I went to see it in Rotterdam a couple of weeks ago and it is
What was it about it that interested him? It was fascinating.
That it was different. That the staging was different. They had this wonderful screen that runs down the middle of the hall with a runway underneath. I don't think he was saying that's what we should do next time. But I think he's saying that it's always good to see different options and see how things we might. It's quite difficult with the Stones at the moment because in the past, typically, they would decide to go on tour for 18 months. And Mark Fisher and I would go off and we'd make a production for them that might cost $10 or $20 million. And we would rehearse it and plan it for 6 months and then rehearse it. And then off they'd go and they'd end up doing 180 shows. But now they're at the point in their career where they commit to doing, a South American tour or a European tour of, only 20 shows or 15 shows. And it's much more difficult to justify the expense of these big shows. Having said that, it has to still look pretty great.
Do they give you a budget? Do they say the budget for this tour is...
No, but I have a pretty good understanding of it. What it is,
Right,
the Stones have always done, in my view, they've always been in it half for the money and half for the joy. of it. And I think most bands do that. I think if you get that balance wrong, if you did it just for the money, that would be the wrong thing to do. And if you did it just for the joy of it, then nobody makes any money and you end up losing money, and that's no fun.
How big can it get? You know, rock and roll shows, you know, during the time you've worked in it, have gone from, you know, the biggest place was the Albert Hall in London almost, wasn't it, to this kind of scale. How big can it get? How many people?
But typically you want to play in an arena or a stadium, because then you can do a tour of stadiums and all roughly the same size wherever they are in the world. And so therefore you know that the stage can only fit at one end, or if you put it in the middle it's a bit more complicated. But you know in the end you want to sell 60, if it's an 80,000 seat arena, you need a stadium, you're going to want to sell 65,000 seats, so there is a finite size that the stage can be.
Right. But it does depend on technology, doesn't it? Because the trick is to make an 80,000 seater arena feel intimate. Yeah. There must be a point beyond which it is impossible.
Also, there's few people who can fill those big stadia. You know, less and less as the time goes on. There used to be tours in the summer, and you'd look around and there'd be eight acts doing stadium tours, and they would all be following each other around, but it doesn't happen so much now, I don't think.
Yeah.
Actually, we've had this already. This is the opening ceremony. Just, have we got the picture of the Queen? Of the Queen, sorry. There she is. There's a Queen. I'm sure you all saw it, the opening ceremony. What was her reaction? It was brilliant. Didn't you talk to her about this moment?
I did. I met her last year, and she said, I said, you know, ma'am, I was responsible for lighting you. She said, I thought the Olympics went terribly well, didn't you? And I said, I thought it did. And I said, you know, ma'am, I was responsible for lighting you as you jumped out of the helicopter. And she said, well, of course, I never saw that bit because I had to hide.
I love the way that she colluded in this. I can't just stand there. I want people to think it's me.
So sweet.
It is sweet. It's brilliant. So where are we? I think we're coming up to probably...
I'll tell you something very quickly about... It was very complicated to get the helicopter into exactly the right position to drop the people within the time frame of the video, the lighting, getting the Queen. But it was very complicated, and there was an amazing helicopter pilot called Mark Wolfe, who was the James Bond helicopter pilot, and they practiced things over and over and over again. So everything had to be called by the lovely Julia from Essex, who would call the helicopter in from position Bravo to overhead, standby, ready to report that the jumpers are ready to go, jump master to report lined up. It was so complicated to say that they gave them code words. So the code word for each of these acts was the name of a James Bond movie. And it made it so exciting to hear it. And you'd hear Julia go, standby heli overhead, odd job, and report Thunderball. Roger, so to goodness. And then you'd be over, and Thunderball was, I'm ready to go, my jumper's in a position. You go, Stadium Control 52733. We have Thunderball. So exciting. and then the thing for the final thing, which is my jumpers have gone and I'm clear, and you heard Mark with this pride in his voice saying, 52733, heading for the Stadium Control, shaken but not stirred.
Oh, it's too far. Meow. I'm fascinated by Julia from Essex. I mean, seriously, I mean, because that's a job that no human being has done before, isn't it? That kind of level of
complexity. There are people who do it, but I mean, she's considered the best at it, sure. You know, and she has to be completely cool and keep everything together. But she also has to make sure that people are relaxed.
It's partly showbiz, technology, it's military, it's everything, isn't
she's
it?
Yeah, she's extraordinary.
It's amazing. Lady Gaga.
Yes, I just put that in because I think she said to you, you mentioned you'd done the Queen, and she said, I thought I was the Queen.
Yes, yeah,
that's right.
Some people
but
think
I've
I'm
the
Queen.
Show.
She's amazing.
Yeah, I've seen
this
the show.
This woman is fantastic. And what's weird about her, I was talking about authenticity in terms of artists. I think she's totally and completely and 100% committed and authentic. This is somebody who dresses up in meat and does this and does ridiculous kind of self-publicizing things. But for sure, she's serious about it. It's contrived, but it's real, if you can understand that. Well, and also, she's an extraordinary singer and an extraordinary piano player.
A lot of what she does is make you put a political point, I think, about Madonna. Because Madonna famously didn't... Madonna said you can't have Madonna singing and Madonna dancing. I mean, you can't have them both at the same time. So if I'm miming, I'm miming. But she makes a point of singing live, doesn't she? And pauses between songs.
Yeah,
get a breath
she
back.
Sings live, and I don't know how much Madonna does. I think she's sort of beyond trying to be better or worse than someone else. I just loved her. She was tricky. She wasn't easy, and she was, because she was absolutely sure at the age of 26 she knew exactly what she wanted to do. And that they weren't always the right decisions, but she was sure of it. And when they weren't right, she would come up and she'd say, "I'm sorry, I got that wrong." And I think she's wonderful.
Well, we're just gonna end really with this extraordinary part of your career, which is that you were working on the tour that nobody ever saw. Nobody ever saw this picture. This was Michael Jackson's 2009 comeback tour, which never happened. In fact, you're going to read something from it. Well, yeah, read something from the diary. Good idea.
I will do. 25th of June. It's a beautiful morning as I drive to the Staples Center with Mark and Demphis. We talk about the show number by number. This song's finished. This needs a little more work. What about the colour in that one? But generally, we're more than happy after last night's run, and we allow ourselves to bask in the delicious comfort of knowing that the pressure is off and this will truly be one of the great shows of all time. I'm sitting at the lighting board when the phone rings. It's my friend Menno Meyers calling me from Paris. "Is it true?" he asks. "The news here is reporting that Michael Jackson's just had a heart attack, has been rushed to hospital." I look at the stage where Kenny's rehearsing the dances. Surely if something had happened, somebody would have called us, wouldn't they? I walk down to the production desk. They tell me, yeah, they've heard something, but it's only on TMZ and they can't really believe anything yet. Kenny looks surprisingly relaxed. "This man's life has been surrounded and fogged in rumour and intrigue," he says. "Until we know something to be true, let's keep on rehearsing. That's what Michael would want us to do." There's a surreal quality about the scene as Kenny continues to work with the dancers, but meanwhile everyone else is on their laptops and mobiles trying to garner more information on the internet. But moments later, the tension in the room racks up a notch. The major networks are starting to carry the story now, with more concrete news coming from the hospital and CNN reporting that Michael's actually died. There's a stunned silence after the nervous laughter of a few moments ago. Surely not. It can't be, can it? Everything seems to be happening in slow motion now. Kenny takes a call from the producer, Paul Gongaware, who we understand is at the hospital with Michael, and then he slumps down in a chair. Someone cries out. One of the dancers collapses into another's arms, and it's clear what the news has been. Around the empty arena, it's suddenly very quiet. Michael Cotton, the set designer, hangs up on a phone call and looks at me with an expression of complete shock and incomprehension on his face and tears in his eyes. People talk quietly in small groups as the occasional clang as a piece of metal is put down on the floor or the crackle of a walkie-talkie, but mostly it's just silent and still. We're all floating in this tiny emotional bubble on the very spot where Michael made his triumphant comeback last night, just hours before this extraordinary tragedy took place. "So this is it," I find myself thinking with some irony. After a few moments, we all gather together out on the floor, holding hands in a big circle, and with tears pouring down his cheeks, Kenny gives a most beautiful valediction. "I've just had a call from the hospital from Paul Gongaware, who confirmed to me that Michael has passed away," he begins. And then he goes on to talk about the man who was his friend and his creative partner for so many years. He tells us that it's our duty to tell the world what Michael has achieved after these few nights, how he's still had his talent and his energy, and how we need to let people know what it is. As an hour later, I walk up the loading ramp and out into the arena for the last time. After a week of creativity and good humour, the place is now an empty vessel that represents only loss. Beyond the literal and emotional darkness of the inside of the building, the bright sunlight outside seems even more surreal than usual.
That's so nice. I for one, can see the massive commercial appeal of your diary, so I sincerely hope they get published. It's a fantastic story, and it's beautifully, beautifully told. Beautiful. Thanks so much, Patrick Woodruff. We're just going to take a 5 or 10 minute break, get some drinks, and we'll be back in a moment. So thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.